Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Melvin Rogers, who is the author of The Darkened Light of Faith, Race, Democracy, and Freedom in African American Political Thought. This was published by Princeton University Press in 2023, and it is quite a seminal book for anybody who's interested in understanding not only African American political thought, but understanding the United States. And I think Melvin has led us through a deep and rich consideration of what it is the United States is and what it means to many people. But I'm going to let Melvin talk all about that. I'd like to welcome Melvin Rogers to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this particular project. Hi, Melvin.
How you doing, Lily? First, let me thank you for having me, because I know we've been playing a bit of tag trying to make this happen. So I appreciate you being patient and being committed. So thank you. A little bit about myself. So I'm a professor of political science at Brown University, where I teach political theory. And I am mostly, I think I'm mostly interested in American and African-American political thought. And I mostly sort of focus on questions that are related to, we might call, the foundations of democracy. But the foundations of democracy not located specifically in sort of institutional structures, although those are very important, but the foundations of democracy is located in us. Do we have the requisite habits and sensibilities necessary to sustain, support, and recreate democratic practices? And what did critical thinkers in the tradition of American and African-American political thought, what did they think was required of us in order to sustain and support and enrich democratic life?
And this book really goes at that sort of fundamental question from so many different angles. But it does it also through the lens specifically, obviously, of African-American thinkers. But it's not just siloing African-American thinkers. You are, from my reading of it, sort of putting in conversation American citizens with the idea of these habits and sensibilities, with this idea of who we are and the we, the people. Can you explain a little bit about the sort of how you came into this project where you have thinkers that array across 200 years, more or less, who are not necessarily, as you say, you know, the founders?
Right. Well, the first thing is that I sort of treat, and I hope the readers sort of experience this, but I treat African-American political thought as our shared inheritance. Shared inheritance in the first kind of local sense as part of America's moral and political discourse and language, and I think shared in a more humanistic and expansive way in this sort of second sense. But I came to this project because after I finished my first book on the American philosopher John Dewey, at the heart of that book was Dewey's preoccupation with contingency and uncertainty and the importance of these ideas to democratic life. I was always thinking as I was working on that book, well, what group of thinkers in the United States has had to grapple with contingency and uncertainty at the very level of their existence? And there are a number of groups that present themselves as candidates, but I have been thinking about African-American thinkers for a long, long time, both as an undergraduate and as a graduate student. And so that was really sort of the beginnings of my thinking alongside my work on John Dewey. And then I wanted to understand why these African-American thinkers and artists remain so committed to the United States amid practices of domination and exclusion. You know, how must they have understood democracy in order to make sense of their own appeals to the polity? And that got me going on the project. I took something of a break as I worked with Jack Turner on the big volume on African-American political thought at Collected History. But there again, I was still constantly thinking about this project. So that's how I came to it. And framed that way, it was me trying to understand this tradition that I've been teaching. And that, as I said, I'm an heir to, as are you and your listeners, and to try to sort of figure out, you know, what did they think? How do they think we had to sort of move and comport ourselves in order to realize the vision of democracy that they had in mind?
And so in thinking about this, and you have this very substantial volume on African-American political thought with lots of entries about lots of different people and their thought and their treatises and so forth. But you have selected to think about this through a number of lenses that is not necessarily a kind of systematic or a, you know, sort of an all-encompassing grouping, that you are very clear in the introduction that you've chosen particular works by particular authors to understand and interpret. How did you sort of, again, you are an expert in African-American political thought. How did you sort of come to approach who it was and what they wrote in the way that you did?
So one of the things about the project is that, you know, the tradition of African-American political thought is both wide and deep. And so the book, in some ways, is not exhaustive. So the aim was to pluck out a set of sort of representative figures that were sort of significant in their own time period with respect to the text that they produced, with respect to the sort of kinds of arguments that they initiated and put into the public conversation, and to sort of use that as a basis for the sort of selection of the thinkers, even as I was simultaneously claiming that they were representative of a whole set of other figures that we don't necessarily see. Some of these figures make an appearance. They don't get sustained attention. They make an appearance. But that was the approach I took, even as I sort of say the book is not exhaustive. There's still much more one could tell. So I'll just use one example of a kind of significant figure, which is the first figure, the abolitionist David Walker. Now, if you were to ask most students of political theory, had they heard of this figure, David Walker, they'll say no. And you might ask some figures who do work in African-American political thought, and they might, but not fully understanding the significance of David Walker. And David Walker's 1829 pamphlet to the colored citizens of the world, but in particular, and very expressly to those of the United States, really inaugurated a kind of contestatory, let's call it that, a kind of contestatory genre that looked very different than African-American thinkers prior to him and looked very different than their various appeals. And the amount of, or the kind of righteous indignation that you see at work in the appeal sets off a long, a subsequent long line of argumentation that looks very different than what was coming before 1829. So the way you suddenly can understand Douglass's famous 4th of July address and the righteous indignation of that text and the way in which he has no problem criticizing the nation, even as he's calling the nation to a higher purpose, there's no way to sort of fully understand that mode of engagement independent of David Walker. So there is a moment that is both, and there is a figure who's critical precisely because he puts in circulation a new mode or new sort of method of critique and a new way of engaging in contestation that becomes, that then becomes subsequently something of the hallmark of African-American appeals and engagements with the nation.
And this is, I learned so much about David Walker because I didn't know. I'm embarrassed to admit, but I will admit it. But you do such a sort of really skilled job of teasing out what are these sort of constant tensions that I think are really the backbone of kind of your thesis in terms of who the United States is, what the United States is, as a concept of a democracy and a republic. We won't go into that conversation because it's not relevant. But also in terms of how these various thinkers are wrestling with that contested confusion in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And so I really found your conceptualization of a national character warring against itself to be striking in terms of leading me through all of this. But it's also the sort of being and becomingness that all the African-American authors and artists that you pay attention to, that you write about, they're all in that zone. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit about this concept of national character warring against itself?
Sure. So I think the first thing to say is that there are sort of two important components of the thinking of these figures that work together. And one component is just their view of human nature as a site of transformation, that we're the kinds of creatures that are not settled and done. The second has to do with the way in which this first interacts with our political system. And so the second is the idea that the legitimacy of democracy, what makes it worthy of respect and obedience, is never finally captured by the institutions that speak in our name. And that's because there's always excess problems that sort of exceed what those institutions are speaking to. And that the legitimacy of democracy for these figures, they weren't alone, a great many white figures thought this as well, the legitimacy of democracy hinges on its ability at critical moments to be responsive right, to the sort of, let's call it the excessive voices that are not captured by their institutions. And this gives you a notion of both the people that are being represented by their institutions, right? That's that, you know, a kind of descriptive account of the people. And it also gives you an aspirational view of the people, people not yet. So now we have a view of human nature that fits very nicely with a kind of normative story about what makes democracy dynamic. And in that context, we can have both the nation sort of acting or comporting itself in light of a set of values that are in tension with a group of people demanding that they be properly recognized. The values that are orienting people, in fact, on the ground is exclusionary. And thus we have the tension. Or to put it differently, now we have the nation warring against itself.
And you also talk about that in the first part of the book, which is, you know, chronologically a little bit earlier in the history of the United States. But you talk about this as the sort of problem with the Republic. Mm-hmm. So you've just given us the discussion of the issue around the legitimacy of democracy, but you spend a lot of time discussing the idea of a republic, which is where one is not supposed to be dominated, mm-hmm. with the unfortunate and horror of chattel slavery, which is a form of domination. And that these were, again, also points in tension in the United States. Can you talk about how Walker and others were sort of dealing with that concept?
Right. So if we go back a moment to the claim I made about what makes democracy legitimate, the kind of vibrant, its ability to be vibrant and responsive to one's fellows. Well, the reason why you want that to be the case, the founders thought that this was quite important. The reason why you want this to be the case is because you want to guard against those moments in which citizens are not participating, do not exercise control over the sort of practices and the institutions of governance that will direct and control their lives. If citizens find themselves in that kind of position, they're not citizens at all, they're subjects, because they really are subjected to the arbitrary mercy of those institutions and the individuals that are in control of those institutions. So part of what democracy was about, and I make no distinction between democracy and what we might call republicanism, the philosophical tradition of republicanism, I make no distinction here. And I don't think it's useful to make one. But part of what democracy was about was trying to ensure that ordinary everyday citizens can participate in the practice of self-governance. And it was premised on the idea that they could do that without having to bow to bosses, kings, or popes. Because if they did have to bow, they would find themselves in a position in which they were subjects to another. Effectively, they would be in a position of slavery.
Yeah, and I found that thinking about the role of being in a democracy, although you did talk about it as a republic, and I'm not going to get into that silly debate with regard to the United States, which is both a republic and a democracy, that it really helped me to think about the concept of citizenship in general. Mm-hmm. Because this is also one of the distinctions that you tease out of the work, is that the problem between political citizenship and essentially slavery, where you had no standing as a citizen to begin with. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how the thinkers that you are encountering in the book thought about this concept as they traced it in each of their different kinds of writing, how citizenship is, again, a kind of enveloping position.
So, I mean, so this is a bit of the book that I think early on in the book that is a bit tricky and complicated. And it's tricky and complicated because when we think about the story of the American Revolution, we think about colonists fighting against the sort of threat of domination, and that they were fighting for their freedom. If we sort of drill down on that a bit, part of what the colonists were fighting for were the restoration of rights that they had previously had that were now denied. And because those rights were not being restored by King George and Parliament, the colonists argued via the Declaration that that a king that has the sort of temperament and sensibilities of a tyrant is not fit to be the ruler of a free people. This problem is very different when compared to the conditions of African Americans. Because when you sort of pay close attention to the institution of slavery, the issue is not that Black people had standing in that society that is now denied. The argument is that they were never thought to have standing in the first place because they were never thought to be fit for citizenship. Very different than what the colonists were experiencing. So in the case of the colonists, what you need is, on the one hand, break away from the British crown and create a set of institutions that sort of acknowledge rights that you previously had. In the case of African Americans, insofar as you are sort of arguing for a transformation of the society to which you belong, you need something quite more. Laws alone will not by themselves sort of create a standing that you never had. You actually now need to be viewed by your counterparts as the kinds of creatures that have that standing, right? And you need to view them as the kinds of creatures that are worthy of being in relationship with you. Seems to me the difference between these two is the difference between political standing and a kind of standing that's not just simply about political institutions, but is about culture itself. You need to be regarded by the culture as such, as a member of that society withstanding.
And I found that the sort of move to think about culture in this way is particularly important because we are a juridical society. We are a litigious society. We always are hearkening back to what the Constitution says and interpretations of the Federalist Papers and so forth. But what you're tracing here, particularly in the chapter where you're looking at different components of aesthetics, mm-hmm. where you are exploring the issues around lynching from the perspective of Billie Holiday's song, from the images used by the NAACP, from Ida B. Wells's articles, that you're sort of demonstrating a sort of broader conception of what culture is and what it does in a democracy. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you pulled that chapter together, because it's also a kind of a pivot point in the book to move from sort of the original section to the sort of second section.
Mm-hmm. So given what I've already said about the importance of culture, one thing that immediately emerges, or what I hope this now equips the reader with, is a way of understanding the writings of the figures that populate this tradition that I'm calling African-American political thought. So why is it, when you look at David Walker's pamphlet, he's on the one hand talking about the sort of problems of American institutions insofar as they are bound to slavery, that in some way is presupposed. You also see this in another figure in the 1830s, Hosea Easton. But all of these figures also seem to constantly be putting a question to Americans: do you like the way you look? given this picture of you that I'm describing. And if you sort of continue along this line, I think it is quite significant that when you sort of read figures like Mariah Stewart in the 1830s and you read in Frederick Douglass in the 1850s, there's both a concern about institutions, but they're also a concern about society and the habits and sensibilities of society. And by the time you get to Du Bois, Du Bois is most explicit, W.B. Du Bois is most explicit in that 1903 work, The Souls of Black Folk, in which you see very clearly this movement between institutional analysis and this movement between a sort of meditation on culture that makes possible the disregard of Black life. This constant working on two levels was at the heart of Ida B. Wells' reflections in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and Billie Holiday's a performance of that song Strange Fruit, which is about lynching. Ida B. Wells is very much concerned about the absence of anti-lynching laws. She wants anti-lynching laws on the books. But she's also very sensitive to the invisible laws that make possible the lynching of Black people without penalty. That sort of police the boundaries between Black and white life, and that authorizes, as she says at one moment, any white person to sort of basically say that a Black person has violated them. And one has to ask, well, Ida B. Wells, given where you are in time in the late 19th century, given that we've gone through the Civil War, given that we've gone through Reconstruction, that has collapsed, it has failed, what makes you think that this could work? And I think behind this is this idea of human beings as aesthetic projects. We're not settled. And so along the path that we've been following from the 1820s down to Ida B. Wells, we see different attempts to stage and dramatize the problems that Black people are confronting and the ways in which the problem that they're confronting has everything to do with the problem of white life, right? And what I think is significant here is that when you take Ida B. Wells and Billie Holiday together, one of the things that you come to realize is that for them together, democracy does not merely live in our institutions. It can also live in our bones, in the movement of our bodies. So Billie Holiday's performance of Strange Fruit and the ways in which she would often sort of dramatize on her face the horror that one should feel at bearing witness to lynching was an attempt to sort of dramatize what it means to be horrified by the violation of democratic values as embodied in the violation of Black life.
And this is something that we are still wrestling with, obviously. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, too regularly. It's clear that the Black Lives Matter movement is a direct descendant mm-hmm. of this kind of spotlight on the violation of Black bodies. So even as we're talking about an aesthetic component, a song mm-hmm. that it highlights for us an understanding of the problem that's at the heart of the American experiment as you are discussing it. But I wanted to bring you to this question of the sort of shape of the book itself. Mm-hmm. You talk about sort of the earlier works that were before the Civil War, David Walker and some of the others that you highlight. But then you reach a sort of point where you use the phrase that you've sort of, I forgot where it came from, but you will, I'm sure, tell me. A society that never was, but may yet be. And that you sort of move from sort of this, I guess, on a certain sense, setting up the foundation of thinking about African-American thought to what you say are essentially four questions about domination and republicanism, which we've already talked about, but the capacity for transformation that the writers in the second half of the book are wrestling with in a somewhat different way. Mm-hmm. And so you have what we were just talking about with regard to chapter five, but you go through in terms of Du Bois and Baldwin as the sort of trajectory out. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that capacity for transformation?
Mm-hmm. So the first part of the book is helping to bring into focus why culture becomes the ground on which the appeals, the battle takes place. And the first part sort of gets us to a moment in which, on the one hand, you have a set of thinkers that think we're susceptible to transformation, that they want to sort of deploy that as a way to sort of resist practices of domination, and that they do this partly because they sort of see in democracy a kind of openness. As we move to part two, I try to make good on this argument about sort of democracy as a site of openness. Do we have historical figures that are central to America's moral and political life that thought in this way? Jefferson, of course, Whitman, of course, becomes quite important in this regard. And do we have figures that also thought, as part of the dynamic of democracy, that we were aesthetic projects in development? And so the second part is about trying to sort of flesh that out in various ways, right? So we have Ida B. Wells and Billie Holiday deploying horror, the emotion of horror, as a way to generate affirmative agency, right? So sometimes we might think of horror as generating in us a kind of paralysis, and they say no, because we are the horrors. And if we are the horrors, then we can also be the site for potentially transforming ourselves. By the time you get to someone like, you know, Du Bois is interested in both the sort of aesthetic dimension of who we are, but the emotional dimension of who we are. And so Du Bois is also playing with these concepts in an interesting kind of way. By the time we get to someone like Baldwin, all of these things are at work. Baldwin both sees us as open. He thinks that democracy turns on the description of the people that is both the people in fact and the people not yet. But Baldwin also knows that we've been scarred by our history. And so what does it mean to both appeal to one's fellows, to appeal to their emotions, to see them as open to being transformed, while simultaneously taking seriously that the ground from which you begin will be a ground that is stained, and that what comes out on the other side, both with Black and white people alike, will also be stained, right? And so that's sort of the trajectory of part one to part two, and then ultimately sort of where we land at the end. And by the time we get to the end, I think the defense of aspirational politics that we've been laying out across the whole book is, by the time we get to the end, I think appropriately chastened, as it should be given our racial history.
And And that's one of the, of course, places where you leave the reader, which is we are in this country that has long been, quote, optimistic about much, about newness and progress and so forth, but that we can't really legitimately take that on without understanding the past that we would love to erase. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it's historical. This is the reality of the United States. And the thinkers that you wrestle with are all, as you say, sort of trying to put the two things together. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to discuss a little bit about any of the thinkers that are sort of you're threading through this book, how they were able to essentially maintain those two threads that we've been talking about.
Right. I mean, so one of the important arcs of the book is the role that faith plays in the story. So we now know that these thinkers believe that what sort of underwrites democracy is a kind of dynamism. We now know that that dynamism will include two accounts of the people, the descriptive account and the aspirational account. We now know that they see us as human beings, as dynamic, and that part of what they think can move us is both it is sort of appealing to us as creatures not done, and who can be emotionally sensitive, and emotionally sensitive as the basis for political transformation. But they also know in the final analysis that what democracy turns on in the very first instance is that ordinary, everyday individuals can render judgments about the forces that will govern their lives. You can persuade them in one direction, or they may say no. And so as you're appealing to them, you never exercise sovereign authority over them. And the fact that they can potentially say no, that white Americans can potentially say no to their Black counterparts, raises the question, well, what will keep you committed? What will keep you fighting against these forces? And the argument that I make is that all of these figures are bound together by a commitment to faith. And that faith for them is, as I say in the book, a kind of running ahead of the evidence you need to finally justify the position you take. And this is a very difficult, a very challenging position to assume. And it's one of the threads of the book that made completing this book quite difficult, because one has to say, as I say at the end, the drama of the book, the subject matter is still going on. And one has to wonder, well, is this the right historical moment to advance this kind of argument, given what we're seeing in the United States now? And yet it seemed to me that this is what these thinkers were committed to, this idea of faith. And the other thing that it reveals is that for them, faith is part and parcel of political life, especially in cases where what's at stake is the very foundation of your being, right? What's at stake is a matter of ultimate things. Right? Those, whether it's in the United States or elsewhere, those who are engaged in intense sort of conflicts here and elsewhere to have your society recognize you as an equal. Typically, the evidence is not pointing in your direction. This is precisely why it's a battle. And so then what would make you believe that you could actually realize this thing where the evidence is often pointing in the opposite direction, or minimally it's mixed? And it seems to me that there has to be, or for these thinkers, there has to be some vision of what it means to be a human being that can become the basis for one's faith. And that seems to be what's driving these figures.
And I appreciated the essentially not necessarily a reconfiguration of an understanding of faith, because it's not necessarily a religious faith, but it is a kind of religiosity about what one has to sort of think about or believe in about one's fellow citizens, or the potential for one's fellow citizens. And I wanted to ask you a follow-on to that, because you spend a lot of time in the discussion of democracy talking about the fact that democracy makes all of us vulnerable. We are all vulnerable within the context of democracy. And in that capacity, a Black person, a white person, an immigrant, we are all dependent on others in a very real way for what the country will be. Can you explain a little bit about how this vulnerability is sewn into democracy, particularly in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think you've already sort of laid it out quite nicely, which is that the significance and the inescapable character of dependency is what creates the sort of conditions of our vulnerability. And the thing that I think is important in the context of the United States is the way in which race is often deployed to run interference between some Americans' recognition of that vulnerability. So that even when, and this was something that, you know, James Baldwin was very much aware of, this was something that sort of defined the sort of migration story as Black people left the South to go north. Big businesses were managing the influx. One thing that could be said to one's white counterparts is that, look, you're not like them. But in focusing on not being like them, you find yourself, unbeknownst to yourself, being exploited by those very forces. But at least I'm not like them. And so this is what I mean when I say that race runs interference and sort of obscures both our shared vulnerability and sometimes our shared vulnerability that comes about because of the sort of expansive notion of freedom that democracy makes possible. Democracy, you know, democracy as a sort of social and political ideal doesn't necessarily have within itself its own safeguards. The safeguards are us. Democracy has no problem with constructing institutions that can function like a Trojan horse to itself. And unless we have the requisite habits and sensibilities to say, wait a second, I see you came through that door, but you're inconsistent with the commitments. Right. So this idea of vulnerability, of course, you know, for me, I derive this idea both from the tradition, but of course, in a contemporaneous way, I derive it from Danielle Allen, right? Talking to strangers, and this emphasis on democracy as making us vulnerable rather than securing sovereignty and mastery. I mean, this is an extraordinarily important idea, but of course it was an idea that Black people knew all along. And that someone like James Baldwin wants to say is the hallmark of democratic freedom. That vulnerability simultaneously creates possibilities. And to the extent that one wants to insist on their sovereignty, you are failing to grapple with what democracy demands, that your freedom is intimately bound up with vulnerability and the opportunity for development, for growth, for expansion of society is connected to that. So to the extent that you insist on your sovereignty and the absence of vulnerability, that means you don't court the possibility to expand yourself.
Right. And in this regard, because this is some of what you talk about later in the book, that this sort of the way that this vulnerability makes you feel, mm-hmm. right? So it becomes an affect as an unknown or unrecognized component, particularly for white America, is also where we, I would think, and I think you sort of tag this in a bit, where white supremacy comes from.
Of course.
And so that vulnerability tied to the freedom is one that has to inevitably, you have to come to terms with feeling vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. You know, the argument, you know, white supremacy is really sort of valuing white lives over non-white lives. I mean, that just is what it basically is. But at the heart of this is that it responds to a set of existential questions that we all confront. Who am I? What is my purpose? What is my place in this society? White supremacy responds to all of those questions. And this is why Du Bois thought in Darkwater that white supremacy was a kind of, you know, he said whiteness is a kind of religion. Because religions, the great religions, speak to those existential questions, right? And the part of what these figures wanted to sort of lay bare is that what is missed is that the ability to sort of answer those questions can't be disentangled from the vulnerability that's part and parcel of helping you figure out who are you and what ought you to, right? What ought you to do and what is your place in this society? And, you know, Baldwin was very clear. These are very difficult questions for anyone to face. And because they're difficult questions, there are, historically, there have been white Americans who know what they are doing when they engage in white supremacy and when they dominate others. And then there are a great many others that are not so clear what they're doing when they comport and act in the name of white supremacy, even when they don't call it that, right? And Baldwin's quite clear, this is a very difficult thing to grapple with. But he was also insistent, and I think the tradition bears this out, is that one's white counterparts need to sort of figure out their relationship to those existential questions. Right? And they need to figure that out in relation to the history that they have given life to. And African Americans are part of helping to bring it into view. But ultimately, one's white counterparts and the ways in which they sort of dominated the trajectory of the nation, and thus we can say the nation, has to work out its relationship to that history.
Yeah, that is the inheritance.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always talk about slavery as the inheritance of the nation, but in terms of understanding who I am in a democracy mm-hmm. is also my inheritance. Mm-hmm. This is a fantastic book, Melvin.
Thank you.
Now that it's come out, what are you working on?
Well, I'm still, you know, we write books, you know this, Lily, we write books, we write articles, and then we move on to the next thing. And I spent so much time on this book, I felt that, you know, I have to effectively hit the intellectual red carpet to support it and to try to generate allies for it, because it just seems to me, you know, we write these books with the hope that someone will take it up, will read it, and will join in the conversation, even if in a contestatory way. And that sometimes you'll generate allies for it that will say yes. And sometimes you will create an audience that didn't know that they existed and were ready for this book. But I have put sort of pen to paper on two new projects. One is on origin stories, which picks up where this book ends. And that book on origin stories is basically about our preoccupation with origin stories as a genre of talking about our history and the ways in which that preoccupation with origin stories turns out to be our failure to grapple with our freedom. Why? Because origin stories settle existential questions, right? Origin stories are about fate. Origin stories are deterministic. You try to violate your origin story and see what happened to you. So origin stories do a lot of work. And in doing that work, I'm gonna argue, I think that it actually gets in the way with the sort of danger and possibility that comes with democratic life. And then I think the other book project that I've sort of put some thoughts down on paper is about a figure that I spent a great deal of time with in this book, Du Bois. And it's an attempt to sort of now go back to my roots as a political theorist that picks on one thinker and focuses on one thinker, but to try to figure out, to tell a story about how Du Bois holds together from Souls of 1903 to Dark Water of 1920 to Dusk of Dawn of 1940. That there is actually a very sort of, there's a coherence to Du Bois. It's quite powerful. And that coherence also contains development and departures, and so that's another project that I've put some thoughts down on paper for both of those projects. But we'll see.
Well, whichever one gets published next, I hope you'll come talk to me about it on the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure, and I assume one can purchase this book at Princeton University Press's website. Is yes. there a brick and mortar store to which you would like to give a shout out?
Any brick and mortar store that people care about.
Great. That sounds great. Thank you, Melvin Rogers, for joining me today to talk about The Darkened Light of Faith, Race, Democracy, and Freedom in African-American Thought. It has been a true pleasure and an honor to chat with you about it.
Thank you.